So I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead, but when we get to the last paragraph, then I know, because I was a member, that the people who are members, for example, of the Anglican Church, who do not believe in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. From the way the statement is phrased there, it sounds as if the Catholic Church considers heretical.
So the question is having to do with the Anglican Church, and are they considered heretics because of what is here? I would have to do a little more research. I mean, based on what you said, I think that that makes sense, because there is there was that separation, historically speaking, under King Henry VIII in the 16th century in England, and there is this denial of certain things that are revealed, the Eucharist and other sacraments. So yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah.
Anglican Catholic say something
there? No, this would be Anglicans.
Presbyterian.
Yeah, or Episcopalian. So yeah. I wanted to. Yeah, question.
How does the church deal with heresy? If somebody, for example, if somebody is a heretic, maybe ignorantly a heretic, or they were a heretic and they were aware of it, but they have a moment where they realize their error, they want to come back. Is that a possibility?
Yeah. So I think based on this, it has to be an obstinate denial. And so someone who doesn't know, that's usually not rooted in the will. That's usually not obstinate. But this also came up because, again, this went back to the martyrs. I mean, imagine if there's two Christians being led to the wild animals, and all you have to do is burn some incense to the gods, and one remains steadfast and goes to death, and the other just says, yeah, to save my life, I'll do that, right? Because then there was this, wow, I mean, really? Again, it's easy for us to say. But so then there were councils and there were meetings about, should we just accept these people? They called them the lapsi, they had lapsed. Should they be allowed to come back? And if so, should they only allowed to come back once? Or should, hey, you had your chance, and if you ever do that again, the way the church described it was the mercy of God. Of course they can come back. Now, they might have to make some formal profession to repudiate those beliefs or to repudiate to, but we see this even with some of the martyrs. They were, I was just reading some of the stories of, last week we celebrated St. Lawrence Ruiz and his companions. He was born of a Chinese father and a Filipino mother. And he was a father of three. And, they were undergoing these amazing, just gruesome punishments or martyrdom. And some of them gave in. But other ones were strengthened by the example of those other martyrs. And so they didn't give in. But yeah, so those who fall away and those who fell away are able to come back into the church.
And what about somebody who has officially converted? Let's say they were baptized and then they converted to another faith. Mm-hmm. Are those no longer fit in the category of heresy?
Yeah, so that's another thing where it used to be, up until 2010, actually, and this was interesting because I was studying canon law at the time in seminary. It used to be that if you wanted to leave the church, for example, you had to submit a letter to your pastor or to the bishop or something and said, I repudiate the Christian faith. I'm out of here. I don't want anything to do with it. Under Pope Benedict, there was a change in canon law, which basically said, you can never leave the Catholic faith. You can never leave. Because now, you might fall away. You might stop practicing. You might say, I don't want anything to do with this. But because of the power of baptism, you can never be unbaptized. You can never be rebaptized, but you can never be unbaptized. And so that's what St. Paul also said is the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. The gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. They can't be taken away. And so someone, again, more often we see someone who falls away, maybe because of weakness, maybe because of choice, or maybe because of something that happened to them. But no, you can never leave the Catholic faith or even the Christian faith, because again, once you're baptized, that adoption is for keeps. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, I left the church in the 60s before Vatican II, because I never was really catechized well. And then when I I was thinking about coming back, they said to me, well, you already belong to the bishop here.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know the bishop here. I was never in this state in my life, and I didn't know you can transfer from one to the other. I was a big surprise to me.
Yeah.
But on the heresy, I want to know if you, like, how much do you have to believe? If it's not on the sheet, is it not required to believe those things?
So the question is, if it's not on the sheet of the creeds, or creed, I guess we could say, do we have to believe it? The deposit of faith, which is what is essential for our salvation, the deposit of faith closes with the death of the last apostle. In other words, anything that comes after the last apostle, and we usually say that's St. John, we can find everything in the scriptures and in tradition that is necessary for our salvation. Now, doctrine develops, right? So when we see that, well...
Particularly thinking about Mary.
Yeah.
We have
so,
more Mary days than
right.
Jesus days.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. So the question has to do with Marian apparitions and things like that. Is that essential for our salvation? And the answer is no. That's not divinely revealed as must be believed. There are approved apparitions, meaning the church has taken a look at certain apparitions. Probably the two most famous or popular are Fatima and Our Lady of Lourdes. There are many others as well. Those are not essential. I think the way that I would say, and I think that the church would say, is that this is maybe icing on the cake, right? It's very helpful. The message that Our Lady reveals at these places is a message of prayer. It's a message of obedience to God's commands. It's a message of Christ-like imitation. So in that sense, it's helpful. I think it's comforting for us to know that we have a Heavenly Mother who is interceding for us and praying for us
but
and all that.
We have to, I mean, Jesus is interceding for us, so why do we have to go to Mary to intercede on behalf of Jesus?
So if we have Jesus as our mediator, why do we need Our Lady? I think there's going to be a whole class on Our Lady, but just briefly, in the Old Testament, the king had many wives, and so they didn't know who was the queen. And so it actually, the role was the queen mother. It was the mother of the king that was the queen, and she would take the needs of the poor ones to her son. Now, again, for someone who loves his mother, I mean, can you imagine if you're the king and you have a peasant who comes into the throne room, and all we have to offer is, we don't offer anything perfect because we're not perfect. So let's say this was the example of St. Louis de Montfort. All we have is a piece of fruit, and it's a rotten piece of fruit that we want to give to the king. But it means a lot to us because, hey, it's coming from us, so the king would want that, right? Wrong, right? Why would the king want, what would he do? So what do? You're going to go to the mother of the king, and you're going to say, hey, could you give this to your son? And tell him it's from a close friend of yours, and maybe he'll accept it, right? So the queen takes a golden platter, garnish, puts the piece of fruit on it, takes it to her son and says, son, I want you to accept this piece of fruit. It's from a really close friend of mine, and I think you'll like it. Right? Is the son going to say, Mom, I don't need that? No. It's coming through the hands of his mother. It smells like his mother. He's going to say, yeah, I'll accept that. And I'll accept that peasant as well. Right? So I think that's where the role Our Lady plays. But no, to answer your question, not essentially. The things that are in the creed.
Was way out.
Yeah. The things that are in the creed regarding Our Lady are true, though.
But that's yeah. Actually relatively minor compared to all the things we're supposed to be doing now. And then I was at another class last week, and they were talking about the prayers, and you talked about going from the we believe to the I believe as more of an impact. And in that class, they were talking about some other prayers, not the ones you say every day, but there are all of these different things you can say. And two things about them. One is to replace the plural with yourself in every place that it appears, and it's certainly much more impactful when you do that. And the second thing was that when you're looking at some of these prayers, that you can see in the interstices of these prayers how the three parts of God interact with each other.
Right.
That's a little more intellectual.
Yeah. So I have a couple of discussion questions for you, but before I do that, I just wanted to go over just a couple of kind of interesting heresies from the early church. One was called modalism, which, especially if you're thinking of actors on a stage, it would be the same actor, but he'd be playing three different parts because they would have a different costume for them, right? And so people would say, well, is that what the Trinity is? It's just different person, it's the same person, but wearing three different masks, right? That was a heresy because, right, no, we're not talking about one person playing three different roles. We're talking about three persons in one God. Yeah.
Is schismatic a mortal sin?
I think it's the kind of thing where I think it could be a mortal sin based on the level of will involved and the level of understanding. Like, is this something, again, was this accidental or was this like freely chosen?
Is it
a mortal sin to be a schismatic or to be in schism? So I think that it's a serious issue. It's usually you're not going to accidentally become schismatic, but there are some other, you know, factors to be in there. Another heresy, which again doesn't really make sense to us now, but kind of is hard to understand, would be what was called patripassionism. In other words, the Father suffered. And so you're like, well, if God is one, does that mean that the Father died on the cross? And it's like, no. The Son died on the cross, right? So again, kind of makes sense to us now, but and then even some of the analogies that we use are not precise, even when it comes to the equilateral triangle. You know, three equal angles, three equal sides, one shape. Okay, that's a little helpful. St. Patrick, we all kind of know the three-leaf clover, right? But even that's not an exact image. That's maybe helpful to get us there. But the main things those two analogies don't tell us about are the relations, right? Relationships. I mean, isn't it funny that we spend so much time in our human lives focused on relationships? I mean, I work at a high school, right? But it's funny because that's what God is, right? God is relationships. And again, he's inviting us into that relationship. So we use analogies to help us to describe God, but ultimately we'll never fully describe him or fully understand him. And then lastly, Arianism is that big heresy from the 4th century, which said that the Son was really just a creature and not God. Are there any questions? I have maybe a couple of study questions, but I want to see if there are any questions. Yeah.
I will accept that to be true, but to me, faith kind of can't exclude any doubt since it's different than there's no proof, you know?
Yep.
So I love the idea of choosing to believe, but
yep.
I guess I'm wondering if it's then a sin to have anything but absolute certainty.
Yeah, so the question has to do with what is doubt, and do you have to have absolute certainty in order to have faith? It was St. John Henry Newman who said, he was an Englishman from the 1800s, he said that 10,000 questions do not equal one doubt. In other words, it's okay to ask questions, right? And actually, we should be asking questions, because if we think we know it all, then, you know, we probably don't, right? So I think it's good for us to ask questions, and it's good for us to have questions about these kinds of things. And I think that's how the church actually, because of these, especially the early church heresies, that helped the church to define who is Jesus and what is God and who is God and all of this. So I think asking questions is good. I think when it's thinking about doubt, using the word doubt, I think a lot of people approach faith maybe with doubt, which is actually more of a skepticism, right? It's kind of like, this can't be. I mean, even think of the people when they were listening to Jesus speak on the Eucharist in John chapter 6, they said, how can this man give us his flesh to eat, right? It's okay to ask a question, but it's more of a skeptical question like, that's impossible. But remember, for God, nothing is impossible. And so I think just kind of keeping that open mind that maybe it's something I just need to learn, right? Maybe it's something that I don't understand completely. Maybe there's a reason for that commandment or for that teaching or something like that. So again, maybe I'll make that distinction between a question and a doubt. Questions are great. Doubts, if they're stemming from skepticism, probably not so good. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You haven't really talked about the Holy Spirit. And, I mean, that's described as the love between the Father and the Son or some other things. It doesn't sound like that's kind of like an actual person the way the other two are.
Yep.
Something different. So could you talk about that?
Yes, so the question had to do with the Holy Spirit and who is the Holy Spirit? What is the Holy Spirit? Very briefly, the love between the Father and the Son, maybe the best image would be, which again is an imperfect image, but a family, right? Where we have two distinct persons, husband and wife. Their love is so real, their love is so intense that it is another person. It's imperfect image because that seems like the child comes after the parents, where we want to say the Holy Spirit is eternal. But the good news about what I'm doing tonight is I'm just teeing it up for the next priests who are going to be talking about the Son and the Holy Spirit. We learn most about the Holy Spirit through the Son, and it's mostly through, it's going to be called the economic Trinity. In other words, the works of the Trinity. We're going to see the Holy Spirit's works. Maybe not necessarily see with our eyes, but we're going to see through faith the Holy Spirit. So you have to come back on October 16th and October 23rd to learn more. Great, Susan.
No, thank you so much.
Great. Yes, I had, two questions, and you can maybe at your table or if you need to join another table. It's kind of like the Passover. If your family is too small, you can join another table. Two questions, and you can choose one or the other or both. What is meant by saying that we can learn things about God by looking at creation? Right. So what does it mean to say that we can learn things about God by looking at creation? And then the second question is, based on what we've discussed tonight, how does one grow in faith, knowledge of God? Right? So the first question, again, what can we learn about God?